from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
Have we lowered the threshold of expectations for Trump so low that literally not drooling on himself is success?
That's Dan Pfeiffer, former senior advisor to President Obama and co-host of the politics podcast Pod Save America. He's got a new book called Yes, We Still Can, and in it he reflects on the political and cultural forces that enabled Donald Trump's victory. He'll join us to talk about his time in the White House and how he thinks the Democratic Party can counter what he sees as rising racism and nativism in American politics. It's all coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Dan Pfeiffer, one of President Obama's senior advisors and a veteran of both of his campaigns, has published a new memoir, Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. He says he began working on the book the morning after the 2016 election to process his own complicated emotions and to understand how Donald Trump came to win. Dan Pfeiffer is co-host of Pod Save America and a CNN contributor, and he joins us this hour to talk about his memories of the Obama White House, what he calls the radicalization of today's Republican Party, and his advice to Democrats as they seek to gain ground in November. Welcome, Dan Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
We should mention you are, I believe, still a resident of San Francisco, though. You're joining us this morning from New York. Am I right?
I am. I'm in New York, but I've lived in San Francisco for 2.5 years now. I moved here right after leaving the White House.
Like living in San Francisco?
Love it. It's one of the best decisions I've made. My wife is from the East Bay, so we went home. Her family's there. We have a lot of friends there. It's been really wonderful.
Well, there's some wonderful things in your life. You got a new baby, I know. You got a new book, which we're going to talk about. And you also have this podcast, which takes about 1.5 million people per episode. Now, I know there are just about everybody breathing these days seems to have a podcast, but this is one of the more successful ones. And I'm struck by the fact that you've been traveling around with this podcast, and it seems like almost a mission, is it? You want to proselyze people?
Well, I think what we want to do, the podcast really arose, this version of the podcast arose out of Trump's victory and this view that myself and my three co-hosts, Tommy Vietor, John Lovett, John Favreau, who I worked in the Obama White House with, we wanted to find a way to stay involved in politics, but in a way in which we thought we could have the most impact in the Trump era. And they started a media company which has many podcasts beyond just Pod Save America, but Pod Save America, the goal is to try to explain the unexplainable, try to laugh instead of cry about the Trump era, but most importantly, try to engage people in activism around elections, around the issues that matter, whether it's saving the Affordable Care Act or responding to these atrocities that are happening in our immigration system right now, and try to leverage, to use our platform for good to the extent we possibly can. And we've been very touched and frankly surprised about the success of it to date, and we are grateful for a group of truly committed, wonderful, fun-loving listeners, many of whom are getting involved in politics for the first time.
Well, congratulations on that success. And let's talk about how Trump came to be the victor in the race for the presidency. And there are certainly a myriad number of theories, and we don't have time to explore all the theories there are. But you know what I'm hearing from a lot of Democratic people who were part of the Obama administration, like you? We had a bad candidate. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm hearing more often than I ever expected. We had a bad candidate because, you know, Democrats were if they weren't behind Bernie, they were pretty strongly behind Hillary Clinton, including Barack Obama.
I make the argument in the book that this is not about Hillary Clinton, because it's not just we didn't just win everywhere and lose the presidential race. We also lost very winnable Senate races across the Midwest in Pennsylvania. We lost governor's race. We lost up and down the ballot. So there's something more fundamentally wrong with our with the Democratic message and our ability to deal with this new Trump media environment than just Hillary Clinton. And it's worth noting for people who say Hillary Clinton was a bad candidate, she got millions of more votes than Donald Trump. So I think that is way too easy and unfair to Secretary Clinton to blame her for this. It is much more complicated and nuanced than simply one candidate.
So what does the Democratic Party do? I mean, you just can't run on anti-Trump sentiment or try to essentially battle on that front. You're going to have to look at policies and you're going to have to win over Americans. And some are saying the party has to turn more right. and some are saying the party has to turn more left. And you say?
I say that I think the ideological, trying to solve this through some ideological prism is a mistake. I think what we need to do is have a, and this starts with 2018, and then we have to build on it in 2020 in the presidential election. But it is, we have to tell a coherent, easily understood story about why the Republicans are wrong and why the Democrats are right. And that means two things. As it relates to a message about Republicans, I think Democrats should be running against the chaos and corruption of Trump's Washington. And that means the chaos that comes from Trump's crazy tweets, his erratic behavior, the consequences of that through these trade wars are going to raise the cost of goods and hit people right in the wallets, and the corruption we're seeing on a daily basis with Trump and his family enriching themselves, these cabinet members like Scott Pruitt and Tom Price who are using these offices for personal gain. But that's not enough for Democrats. The Democrats need to outline an agenda. And the agenda, and some of this work is being done now, but it includes specific things we're going to do to reform Washington, specific things we're going to do to rein in the corruption, and an economic agenda that speaks to the working and middle class. And I use that term broadly because too often when pundits or political observers talk about the middle class, what they really mean is white working class. When they say the working class, they mean the white working class. I think we have to think about working people broadly, African-Americans, Hispanics, Asians-Americans, whites, across the board. And the Democratic policies are popular if we communicate them in a coherent and clear and concise way.
What do you do, though, about all of the animus that really cropped up and surfaced in this last presidential election against, you go into this to some degree, but also a book called The Great Revolt was just reviewed in the New York Times, not favorably, but essentially two authors, Selena Zeta and Brian Tavlis, they're saying, you know, too many people were feeling they were underdogs. There was a kind of populism about Trump. And they were being not only catered to, or dictated to by the elitists in government and professional politicians, but they felt they couldn't identify with all the people who were getting, in their judgment, a free ride while they were working hard.
There are certainly people in this country who feel left behind, and that includes people who supported Trump. It also includes people who probably would have voted for Secretary Clinton if they had voted, but didn't because they felt like the election didn't matter to them. So it was incumbent upon Democrats to have a broad-based argument that speaks to all of those people. And there is we are in a very polarized time in this country. There has been polarization. Polarization has mostly been to the right, but not entirely. And there are some of those voters we're never going to get back. They were never going to support Democrats. They wouldn't have supported Secretary Clinton. They're not going to support the next Democratic nominee. But there are voters who either voted for Trump, didn't vote, or voted for one of these third-party candidates who are very winnable for Democrats if we can make a compelling case to them as to why we are better than the other side.
When the other side says, though, particularly if they're losing or if they are at least anticipating losses of one sort or another, the elections are rigged or it's all fake news and those arguments keep coming back and that narrative is bought by many people. How do you counter that?
Well, I think this is really an existential challenge for our democracy. And Democrats have to – there will be some voters we're just not going to get, right? That is just simply how it is. But we have to do a couple things that I talk about in the book. One is Democrats need to build up a progressive media infrastructure that will help carry our message because we are vastly outgunned by the right, whether it's Fox News, Breitbart, or any of these Sinclair media, anything else. There's nothing equivalent.
Forgive me, they're a lot better organized, aren't they?
On this, they have been running a aggressive campaign to nullify objective truth for decades. And the rise of social media has made that easier and more effective for them. So Democrats have to do a better job. It's not simply enough to try to communicate our message through cable TV or New York Times or even radio. We're going to have to build up our own messaging platforms. So that's one. Two, we're going to have to make a true argument, a real argument. We're going to have to argue all the points and argue to everyone. I do think I am more hopeful than most that we are just down this rabbit hole of fake news and propaganda because we are sort of in this weird situation where changes in media and the rise of social media, Facebook in particular, have happened so fast that large segments of the population have not yet adjusted to them. You look at young people are much better at discerning fake news from real news, about understanding the right balance of trust and verify when it comes to reading things on the internet. And so young people are going to be much better at this. And so as millennials become a bigger part of the electorate, then I think we're going to be in a better place. But we have Democrats have a lot of work to do, or we're going to end up right back where we were in 2016.
Millennial numbers are pretty high in terms of not only Republicans, but especially libertarianism.
That's right. Millennials are very interesting in the sense that as a generation, they are more involved in their community and in civic life than any generation since the baby boom. They are progressive in the way in which Democrats think about pro-climate change, pro-civil rights, pro-a more decent and thoughtful immigration program, pro-populist economics. But they identify less with party institutions. And so that is why Democrats need an agenda that speaks to this group. And I don't think we're in danger in the short term of having millennials vote for Republicans in mass. There's simply the gap between what they believe in and what the Republican Party stands for right now is massive, impossible to overcome. But they have to believe that the Democratic Party is a vessel that will make their lives better. And that means making a real argument to them. We can't just go in and check the box and say, hey, you're young. Let's talk about student debt with you or marijuana legalization. You need to go in. And this is what Barack Obama, why he was successful about it, is he worked hard and had real conversations and treated young people like adults who cared about a wide array of issues beyond just the sort of stereotypical young people issues, whether it could be our policy in Syria or climate change or immigration or even, frankly, Social Security and Medicare, because many of them are curious of whether the money they're putting in the system is going to be available for them when they come out. And so it has to be something the Democratic Party works on every single day.
Well, Barack Obama also had very good organization tools and was using social media early on in ways that were quite viable. By contrast, Republicans got onto that very quickly and, as you said, used it in ways that turned out to be more successful in many respects. We're talking, by the way, with Dan Pfeiffer. He's joining us, author of Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. And he'll be at City Arts and Lectures on Tuesday, June 26th at 7:30, and at the Commonwealth Club in Silicon Valley on Wednesday, June 27th, both at, well, the Commonwealth Club at 7, City Arts and Lectures at 7:30. More lessons for the Democrats, though. I mean, you talk about Fox News, the radicalization of the Republican Party, and all the ways technology was used and so forth, and that's a big part of it, plus a right-wing media system, I think, is the way we best characterize it. But you also kind of indicate that Obama's policies gave rise to Trump.
I think it was less Obama's policies, so that was part of it. But I think there was you had this mix of things that all happened at the same time, which is you had the Republican Party having a bit of an existential crisis as it went from as a party with a corporatist policy, very pro-Wall Street, entitlement reform, with a base that was becoming much more working class and white working class. So you had a populist base and a corporatist party. The country went through a massive amount of transition in a very short period of time, an economic transformation through the crisis of 2008, cultural transformation, the country getting more diverse. You have technological revolution with – you think about when Barack Obama started running, Facebook was barely around. Twitter was barely around. The iPhone didn't exist. So the world has changed dramatically. And at the face of that was Barack Obama, an African-American president, middle name Hussein, with a story that was very different than the traditional biography of a president of the United States. And the Republican Party decided that they were going to leverage racial division to win votes. And that had real consequences. It's a consequence that that led to Trump. I talk in the book about a conversation that I had with Barack Obama. We were flying on Marine One, the presidential helicopter, back in 2014, where he makes the observation that maybe that it was inevitable the country was going to have a president who was not white, a president of color. Yet it happened maybe sooner than some in the country were ready for. And so you have this reaction on the right of the country that led to the Republican Party under Trump to put away the dog whistle and grab a bullhorn when it came to racial division.
Does that mean that leadership for people like Cory Booker or, for that matter, Kamala Harris is really unlikely if indeed Obama was a little premature in terms of being elected as an African-American president?
No, I think the opposite, actually. I think that we will see – I think both of those I'm big fans of both of them, and I think if they were to run for president, I think they'll both be – excellent candidates. And, you know, we'll probably have 25, maybe 50 people running in our party. But no, I think that we have shown Barack Obama is the first president since Eisenhower to get 51% of the vote twice. and he left office with incredibly high approval ratings. So there is this radicalization among a minority of the country. It's the Trump supporters who make up 38 to 41%. Unfortunately, for a whole host of reasons involving third-party candidates, the Electoral College, Jim Comey's letter, Russian hacking, that ended up being enough to win this election in 2016. But the majority of the country, including those who didn't vote, are people who are people who very much more want a politics that looks like Barack Obama's and Donald Trump's.
Yeah, but how
you
much
have to make the case to get the people to vote?
How much that had to do with racial division, too? I mean, there were many who accepted Obama and then felt that he was being perhaps too simpatico over issues with the police, or even going back to Henry Louis Gates and the police. But I meant, obviously, with Ferguson and places like that, that they felt maybe there was too much leaning toward those who had the same skin color that he had. Racial divisions that were played out by alt-right in these organizations.
Absolutely. There's no question. The Republican Party saw an advantage in people who viewed it that way and decided to leverage that. They had a choice. They could have spoken out against racism. They could have spoken out against birtherism. They frankly could have spoken out against Donald Trump when he was pushing the birther conspiracy back in 2011. But they chose not to because they wanted those votes more than they cared to stand for what was the moral and right thing to do. It's worth noting that the Democratic Party has a problem with white working class voters that is greater than Barack Obama, because we thought after the 2012 election that Barack Obama had hit the floor for Democrats with white working class voters. Hillary Clinton actually did worse than Barack Obama with those voters. And so that raises a whole host of questions for the party about how we improve upon that situation going forward, and what the right, which of those voters we can get back, and what the right approach to do that is.
Well, isn't there kind of an assumption? I mean, you know, a lot of people say that, again, Hillary Clinton was a bad candidate because she didn't go to Michigan, she didn't go to Wisconsin, and so forth. There's an assumption that you're going to have those working class voters, they're labor voters, they've been traditionally Democrats, so they're going to vote Democrat. But that did not occur. And there were certainly warning signals long before that were coming up, you know, in terms of the appeal to white voters generally, along the lines of Donald Trump and his populism.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I believe this is much bigger than Hillary Clinton. I think that's just important to remember, because had Jim Comey decided to not send that letter, I think it's almost undoubtable that Hillary Clinton wins. We're having a very different conversation about the path of politics in America. And we're basically wondering whether the Republican Party can exist in the modern era. Instead, we're having a different one, because elections can turn on the smallest things, and they have dramatic consequences on policy issues and cultural issues in this country. The question is, for Democrats, is not how do you have an agenda that attracts white voters, right? The question for Democrats is, what is the agenda to attract, what is the right message to make to a broad swath of the country? Some of the people who voted for Trump, but also people who didn't vote. Right. And so you have to do both. And one of the mistakes we've made as a party is trying to do this micro targeting of, we're going to say this thing to this group and this thing to that group. We have to, which is what Barack Obama was successful about. I talk about in the book is we should worry less about sound bites and more about a story about America. And that story has to be compelling and speak to people in a way that inspires them, because Republicans win when fewer people vote.
Let me ask you, though, Dan, about how women figure into all this, in your judgment, because, in fact, there was an editorial in the Sunday New York Times you might have seen by a woman who said, I'm educated, I'm an atheist, and I'm a Trump supporter, and I'm a Republican and proud of it. And there were more white women who voted for Trump than voted for Hillary Clinton. So you could say some of this may have had to do with misogyny, or women, you know, favoring Trump because he was a man, or any of those kinds of things, but the chauvinism of whatever male chauvinism can be. But there's a real sense of sort of the assumption, again, that women are going to vote Democratic that isn't necessarily true by any means.
I think after 2016, we should not make an assumption that anyone is going to vote. We have to go get all those votes. And you know, I can't speak to why individual women or others decided to vote for or not vote for Hillary Clinton. The point being is that too many people in this country felt disconnected from not just the Democratic Party, but from politics in general and from government. And we have to address that. Democrats have to address it to win elections. But frankly, as a country, it is not sustainable to continue operating in a world where such a small percentage of our citizens vote. And so we have to be arguing for something much bigger than we're currently having.
If you just joined us, Dan Pfeiffer is with us. He's the author of Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter and Trump, and we're talking about his book and talking about the election, which he started writing about the day after, trying to process it through and trying to understand it and put it into a context that he could understand, and that you as readers and listeners can perhaps understand better, and we'll perhaps hear from you in terms of your own notion of what occurred. There's also this argument, though, Dan Pfeiffer, about President Obama being perceived as being too weak, going on, you know, what the Republicans quickly label as the apology tour. And I must say, you know, I mean, I'm saying the obvious here, but if Obama had done what Trump did and talked about how good you are to your people, to Kim Jong-un and so forth, there would have been probably impeachment. So there is really a strong double standard here. But there was a sense that Obama was weak, especially when he said, OK, red line to you, Assad. And if you cross it, that's going to take retaliation. Trump sent missiles there. That's probably besides the point. But there was this perception of President Obama that he was, you know, too apologetic and not tough enough.
I mean, that's a character that was caricature that was perpetuated by the right. I mean, it's worth looking at. Like, every fact checker in America has pointed out the apology tour thing. It was complete bogus and never true. And this is the advantage the Republicans have with a massive right-wing noise machine, is they can shape perceptions in this country in a way that the Democrats, progressives currently are not able to. The Republican critique of Obama has not been particularly consistent. They argue that he's too weak, but then they argue that his surveillance policies were too aggressive, or his, you know, let's not forget Rand Paul had like a 24-hour filibuster that Obama was using drones to target terrorists too aggressively. And so basically there is no consistency. All arguments that the Republican Party makes, most arguments the Republican Party makes, are completely in bad faith, right? He's too soft on terrorists. He's too tough on terror. He apologizes here. He doesn't. And what is obvious, you point out, there's more than a double standard here. With Trump, one, it's there is no consistency among his critics. People who hated Barack Obama for golfing now have no problem with Trump golfing even more. People who, an attack against Obama because he was willing to explore diplomatic relations and a deal with Iran and Cuba. The argument was he is nicer to our adversaries than our allies, which is complete BS. But now Trump is fighting with Canada and in the middle of a bromance with Kim Jong-un, and you hear nothing from these same people. And like, what gets me is the rank hypocrisy from not just the people on Fox News, who I expect nothing from, but Republican leaders like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, who claim to stand for something more, but at the end of the day are nothing but enablers of this very dangerous presidency.
Yeah, and you actually, in your book, maybe we can talk a bit about this too, talk about Republicans as being clowns, conmen, and racists. We'll perhaps hear from some Republicans in defense. But let me invite you, our listeners, to join us in this conversation we're having with Dan Pfeiffer, reflecting on the Obama White House and the rise of Trumpism in his book, Yes, We Still Can. And your thoughts are welcome. You can join us now at our toll-free number. We invite you to do that. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Any questions or comments are welcome. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website at kqed.org/forum and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. Join us. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about a range of issues, mostly political issues, with Dan Pfeiffer, who's the author of Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. He's former senior advisor to President Obama and currently a CNN contributor and co-host of Pod Save America. We do welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us by calling us at 866-733-6786 or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or simply going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. A lot of calls and emails coming in. We'll get to as many as we can here. Just wondering, though, if I could pursue something that I've wanted to hear what your thoughts are on, Dan Pfeiffer, and that is the Mueller investigation, nobody really knows how it's going to go. They've been almost leak-proof, and yet there's a counter-narrative that's being established. People like Giuliani talking about the investigation, trying to frame President Trump and so forth. And as we get closer to November, it's going to be probably more difficult, whatever they come up with. But don't you think that there's even more ammunition for the Democrats at this point, or as we move toward November, about emoluments? And do the American people really respond, for example, to the fact that the White House is getting very rich and Ivanka and Jared are getting very rich, even richer than
I think that is a very, very important argument to make. I think when it comes to the Mueller investigation, we Democrats must do everything we can to protect that investigation, because if Trump is able to fire Mueller without consequences, it really is a constitutional crisis for this country. And it means there truly are no guardrails on our democracy, because the Republicans have left their – have decided that they will not involve in any sort of checks and balances or exert any oversight over this administration. And if Trump can fire a special prosecutor and have nothing happen, that is a disaster. But the – from a messaging perspective, if I was advising Democratic candidates on what to talk about on the campaign trail, I would think corruption is a much more compelling message than collusion. People, we've been talking about Russia for 2 years now. That the discussion now, even with every passing day where there are more indictments, more charges, more people pleading guilty, you know, Trump's campaign manager is in jail, people's opinions have been pretty locked in on it. Democrats think he definitely did it. Republicans think he definitely didn't. Independents lean a little bit towards Democrats, but it's not the most important issue. I think corruption is something that speaks to people, because there's an opportunity cost for, like, people are paying higher premiums on their health care because we passed a tax bill that benefits Republican donors, that benefits Wall Street and the wealthy, that there are policy consequences for the Trump administration enriching themselves. And so we should be making that argument on a daily basis on the campaign trail, no question.
Let me get to the callers. And Earl, we begin with you. Join us. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to address the issue of low voter turnout, and I wonder, when is someone going to introduce legislation making Voter Day a national holiday? I don't understand why it's not. And you know, you could even go so far as, I understand, in Australia, if you don't vote, you get fined. But that might be a little extreme for this country, but why isn't voting day a national holiday in this country?
Yeah, Earl, thank you for that. That's been an ongoing debate for many years now. Your thoughts, Dan Pfeiffer?
I think it absolutely should be. And I think it shouldn't be just a national holiday, because there will be a lot of people who work in service jobs or other things who will still have to work on that day. But we should make it a national holiday, and we should do a lot of what California is already doing in terms of making it super easy for people to vote by mail. I think it shouldn't be election day. I think it should be election month, where you can fill out a mail ballot and put it in the mailbox. You can go to a voting center on any day, 7 days a week, and vote. And that will make it much easier than if we say, on this one singular day, I hope you can take not just a little time off, but hours off to wait in line. We ask our citizens to vote. It is the responsibility we give them in our government. And then we make it as hard as possible for them to do it in many parts of this country. So I would make it I would make Election Day a national holiday. I would do all these other things to make it as easy as possible to vote.
And more of your calls. We go to next to Karen. Karen, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I was just wanting to ask how he feels about the fact that 80% of Republican voters, pretty much 80% or more maybe, are hereditary voters that vote because their family has always been, you know, I think it might go back to the Appalachia and the civil rights. I mean, in the Civil War, but what do you think about that? Like, how do you reach those people? Because they're like, you know, my grandfather was Republican, I'm a Republican, you know, because I know a lot of people like that.
Locked-in Republicans. What do you do, Dan Pfeiffer?
I think for many of the locked-in, look, we live in a two-party system in this country. The country is closely divided. There are going to be people who are locked-in Democratic voters, locked-in Republican voters. But if it's 80%, if you could make an argument to 20%, of Republicans and move some of them to our side, you would build a very large governing majority in this country. So the key thing is to have a message that speaks to as many people as possible, while understanding that there are large numbers of the other party that you're not going to get. And the same is true for Republicans making an argument to Democrats. But if there are some, we have to have a message that speaks to them.
And let me thank Karen for the call. I'll go to more of your calls in a moment, but let me go to some comments that are coming in by email or tweets. Emma says, how do we challenge on air the lies and brainwashing that is Fox and Friends? Do Democrats have anyone going on the 700 Club, for example? The 700 Club is that long-running TV show hosted by fundamentalist preacher and one-time presidential candidate, Pat Robertson. Dan Pfeiffer.
Well, in my book, I spend a whole chapter talking about Fox and the Republican propaganda machine and make a case for how Democrats should handle this. And one of my arguments is it's not really worth Democratic efforts to go on to Fox, because you can't get a fair shake if you go. And I've done it. I did it in the White House several times. It was never it basically felt like a root canal every single time. What they will just you they will use you're a tool of propaganda when you do it. But now in the age of the internet with digital advertising and social media, we should be making a case to the people. We know how to find the people who watch those shows, and we can make a case to them on our terms. And so I think we can write off Fox the network without writing off Fox viewers. I think that's important.
Quick question. It occurs to me, particularly in light of North Korea, that President Trump wants something that President Obama had, and many felt President Obama perhaps didn't deserve at that particular time in his presidency, which is a Nobel Prize. But otherwise, you could make a case, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, for so many of the things that President Trump has done as being simply almost antithetical or counter to things that President Obama did, right down the line.
Yes, that's right. Trump has no, other than perhaps immigration, Trump has no coherent policy agenda. He ran for office to maybe to become more famous and more rich and ended up winning. He believes in power as an end in of itself. He's not there to try to do any specific thing. So the only framework he has by which to make decisions in this White House is, what did Barack Obama do? I'll do the opposite. And that's what drives all of his decision making. I think ultimately, when you finally get down to the details, I am very grateful that they are so darn incompetent in that White House, because even many of their efforts to try to undo Obama's achievements are, they do incorrectly, they do get caught up in court, or it's not actually doing anything. It's more bark than bite. But that, you're right, that's exactly what he wants to do across the board, because he has no more nuanced or complicated thoughts.
Well, environmentally, you know, it's shocking in many ways how much has been done to try to counter, whether it's advancing coal and the coal industry, or whether it's fighting against climate change, all of those kinds of things. But even now, in the last hour, we talk about migrants, and the Obama administration took an entirely different view and attitude, and many considered it certainly not necessarily effective enough, but the fact of the matter is they were just, we're talking about polarized opposites, really. I want to get to more callers, but let me get to a tweet here. Carol wants to know, so who was to be the Democratic standard bearer for the millennials?
That is a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. And whatever the answer is right now in June of 2018, it's going to look very different in June of 2020. In June of 2006, so year and a half, more than 2 years before the presidential election that Barack Obama won, no one was talking about Barack Obama as the next president of the United States, the next Democratic nominee. There was an entire book written by a couple of very well-known political journalists about called The Way to Win, which was about how Democrats, Republicans could win the 2008 election. That book was missing two words, Barack and Obama. And so what people are looking for in a candidate is going to be shift dramatically as events happen, but also as these candidates get out on the trail. And I am for everyone running. I have no concerns about a crowded primary. I think we should get everyone out there. We should have a great debate about the strategic direction of the party. We should have a huge debate around big policy questions around Medicare for all, universal basic income, federal jobs guarantee, these things that where the party is. And let's have a debate about it, and let's let the voters sort it out. And I believe we'll end up with the right candidate that way, but I would be a fool to predict who it is now. I mean, I couldn't even predict the 2016 election correctly, so I've kind of retired my prediction hat.
I don't make a practice of predicting either, because I've been proven wrong, and it's almost impossible to predict the volatile winds of politics and the way they move. But the two names you so often hear in terms of standard bearers are still Biden and Sanders, and they're pretty old guys.
I think you're going to see a whole host of people. You mentioned two of them, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand. There are some younger politicians like Jason Kander. Kirsten Gillibrand is being talked about. I have no idea who's actually going to run. You know, L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti. There's a lot of people with a lot of talent in our party who are being talked about as potential candidates. And you just don't know until they get out there. It seems obvious now that Barack Obama was going to win, but very few people thought he would actually win the nomination in 2008. So really the voters end up knowing a lot more and being a lot smarter than the pundits like myself. And so we can let them weigh in.
Here's Diana, who writes, organizing Democrats is like herding cats. Republicans use wolves in sheep's clothing to generate fear, driving lemmings from the rear and dangling promises of utopia in the front. And a tweet from Brian, who says, regarding millennials, the popularity of Bernie shows that we want to look at different systems of organization not addressed by Democrats. Hashtag socialism. I don't care if they're black, white, brown, man or woman. If only six people have all the power in America, That's a problem. Let me go to more of your calls, and let me go next to Fremont, and we welcome Cassie. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment here. The comment is, if the Democratic Party wants to fight against President Trump and win over him, only one simple change they have to do. The change is the party has to prove that they are for American people instead of they are for uncontrolled immigrant people. So that's the clear boundary President Trump has set. Now people understand that Democratic Party is anti-American, where President Trump is fully American. So he created the spirit for America, and Democratic Party also has to understand that this country built on immigration. That is fine. It took immigration centuries after century, but it cannot take unlimited number of people. Everything has a capacity, and the people who are already here, they're American, they're also growing with their kids and future generation. So the prime concern to be take care of your own people first before you cry for somebody else.
Yeah, Cassie, I think raises a fascinating point, and one that needs to be looked at by Democrats, Dan Pfeiffer, because the perception was, first of all, that President Obama, though he won twice, was too global-minded or too much concerned about immigrants and not putting America first. This was, in many ways, a very successful campaign of Trump's, largely because throughout the America, you talked about the big numbers of popular votes that Hillary Clinton got, but they were mainly on the East and West Coast. Most of America went for Trump because of America first, didn't they?
I'm not sure that's the case. I think what I would say about the immigration question is it is important to note that majorities of Americans, including large portions of Republicans, agree with the approach to comprehensive immigration reform put forward by Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and the Democrats in Congress right now. Majorities support protecting the Dreamers through the DACA program. Majorities believe in a path to citizenship. Now, there's no question that Trump has been able to energize a far-right base with his nativist white identity politics, demagoguing the issue of immigration. But like, it is a complicated political issue, but we can win this battle. We just have to make the right argument. But the public opinion is on our side. This far-right base that is the tail that wags the dog in the Republican Party that is so far against it. But I don't think we should buy into the premise that immigration is a political problem for Democrats. You could argue, particularly given Trump's numbers among populations of color in this country, that it is ultimately a problem for him and the Republican Party.
I wonder what you say to Penny, though, who writes, let me read her comments. She says, your guess is missing the point. When Obama failed to prosecute bankers in 2008, his voters decided Democrats were too corporate. Then they nominated someone who seemed too corporate in spades, and many voters decided both sides were run by big money and that they might as well stay home or vote for Trump to shake things up. And I think that's a point worth considering when you think about particularly the Clinton Foundation and Goldman Sachs. It hurt her candidacy and it hurts the Democrats.
Well, first, we used to live in a country where the Justice Department was separate from the White House, and there was this distance where career prosecutors made decisions about who was prosecuted, and that's what happened in the Obama administration. That was something that career prosecutors looked at, and they made decisions on it. So it's a little different. We're operating under sort of different rules right now with Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions. But secondly, there's no question that the speeches that Hillary Clinton decided to give on Wall Street were a weapon that were used against her, and it was problematic. I think the Clinton Foundation, which has done so much good in the world, has been demagogued beyond belief. Hillary Clinton suffered from a four-decade attack on her family from the right-wing media. But if we are seen as the party of corporations or Wall Street, we're not going to win. Now, after the Republicans passed a massive tax giveaway to hedge funds, wealthy corporations, billionaires in this country, if Democrats can't make a compelling argument to the public that we are the ones fighting for the working class and they're the ones fighting for Wall Street, then we frankly don't deserve to win elections.
Another caller joining us from Bolina. Sal, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I think progressives make a tremendous mistake in the language that we choose or that we acquiesce in choosing to talk about some of these issues. So if you take the Russian interference with our election, we acquiesce in Trump's repeated claim that, quote, there was no collusion. The kinds of words that we should be using are attack. We were attacked by the Russians. We should be talking about treason. We should be talking about lack of patriotism. We should be talking about the imprisonment of children in Texas right now. We use the wrong words. We use words that are very intellectual, highbrow, and don't stir people to action.
Yeah, I think your argument bears a good deal of scrutiny and sense, Sal. You got to get back to the Vulgate, you know. That's where the word vulgar comes from, the language of the people or the common language, particularly the Democratic Party. In fact, this is a listener who says, if Democrats want to win the white working class, tell the progressive wing to stop vilifying white males. This is the single biggest issue driving whites away from the left. What do you say to that, Dan Pfeiffer?
Well, let me take the questioner's first question. We always need to do a better job, and Democrats have a long history of not being great at this, of making our argument in a way that is easily understood in common sense. Now, I am one who, and maybe I'm soft here, but I am very hesitant to start using words like treason and questioning people's patriotism, because that's something Republicans have done that we thought was disgusting when they did it, and I think we need to be better than that. I still ascribe to, and I talk about in the book, that even if it didn't work in 2016, I still abide by what Michelle Obama said, which is when they go low, we go high. We just have to do a better job of going high. I think we should not be demonizing any group in this country, right? I think we should make proactive arguments for ourselves. We should make a aggressive argument against Republican politicians. But it is foolish to make an argument. I think it is foolish and frankly counterproductive to make an argument against Trump's voters. We should make an appeal to them and get the ones we can. But demonizing them for a choice they made is not a worthwhile use of time for the Democratic Party. I think it's counterproductive.
Didn't it hurt Hillary Clinton immensely when she referred to those Trump supporters as deplorables?
Yes, it absolutely. It based on my understanding of their polling at the time, it was a mistake. She shouldn't have done it, and she apologized for it afterwards. But it had an impact, because it's the most effective attacks in politics are the ones that people believe. And some set of voters believe the Democrats look down their nose at them. We have to do a better job of making sure that's not the case.
Is that the case, the most effective politics or, you know, credible politics, or is it simply negative politics, as we've seen, unfortunately, in too many campaigns?
No, what I mean by that, the most credible attacks in politics are the ones that are believable, right? If you make an argument, like Republicans tried to make all these arguments that Obama didn't care about average people. That may have been believable to the far right, but that was not believable to average voters, right? And because Obama was a person despite his unique background, who seemed like a very normal guy in an extraordinary situation. I believe and will always believe, and maybe some will call me naive, that it's what Barack Obama believes, and we talk about this in the book, that is ultimately doing the right thing, even if it's politically painful in the short term, is the best politics over the long term. And so argue in the book that Democrats can't look at what Trump did to win and try to do the same thing. We cannot become a paler shade of orange in our political strategy. We have to have basically the bizarro version of Trump, where he is being dishonest. We have to be assiduously honest and fact-based. Where he is being divisive, we have to be unifying. Where he is fear-mongering, we have to be inspirational. And that is ultimately the path to success for Democrats.
Here's James. James, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Good morning. In, let's see, November of 2016, Gretchen Morgenson wrote an article in the New York Times entitled, How Letting Bankers Off the Hook May Have Tipped the Election. Senator Elizabeth Warren was on the forum in May of 2014. She pointed out that 900 people went to prison in the George Bush Sr.'s administration over the saving of the loan crisis. Barney Frank, in April of 2015 on the KQED forum, was questioned, and he said he didn't understand why Barack Obama didn't put anybody in jail. It's not only Barack Obama, it's Eric Holder, Loretta Lynch, James Comey, and Robert Mueller. So why do you say that Barack Obama did the right thing when he and his administration did the wrong thing? Nobody went to jail. Only one person One banker went to federal prison, whereas 900, according to Senator Elizabeth Warren, went to prison, federal prison, not some county jail.
Yeah, they could have used RICO, I think. Dan Pfeiffer, let's hear what you have to say.
Like the, I want to be very clear on this point, which is the President of the United States, at least prior to Donald Trump, the President of the United States does not put people in jail. They use career prosecutors, the federal, in the Department of Justice, who look at evidence and then make decisions about what cases are prosecutable. And then judges and juries make those decisions. So Barack Obama didn't not prosecute people. He did not, he did not refuse to put people in jail. That's not a decision that he has any involvement in. And that's how our system works. And what President Obama can do is appoint regulators who will offer fine, who will investigate and offer fines. And most importantly, he can change the law. And so coming out of the 2008 financial crisis, what he did was pass the most aggressive Wall Street reform since the days of the Great Depression. And so the things that are in his control to try to make this country better, he did the best he could. Now, I totally understand why people are angry about it. You look at what happened, what Wall Street did to this country, how people suffered, and then how Wall Street, because of the way our economy works and economic inequality in this country, benefited, were right back on their feet really fast, while a lot of Americans are still struggling to dig out from that hole. So I completely understand the anger. Just want to be very clear that this idea that President Obama should be throwing people in jail is the sort of thing that happens maybe in the Trump presidency, but prior to that happened in dictatorships and authoritarian regimes across this country, across the world.
Let me thank James for his call. And here's Curtis, who writes, Russian bot farms have influenced social media around the world to sway elections. It's ongoing and effective at persuading voters. That in itself might be enough to turn elections against either party. What's the solution to this propaganda machine?
I think it's going to have to be aggressive intervention against those countries and sanctions and the like. Unfortunately, this administration seems less than interested in that. But the platforms themselves, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, whoever else, have to be much more aggressive at getting these bots off the system. And they were too lax in 2016. They have talked about that they didn't fully understand the threat. There is still sometimes a bias against kicking people off the platform. I understand why they think that, but this is a existential threat to democracy, and they have to do a better job.
And before you spoke about the semantics of all this, when you have a country like Russia really trying to undermine our republic and our election system and everything, is treason really, or words of that kind of force, to
what?
Not, I mean, they sound in many people's minds just absolutely right and precise.
Well, I think we need. Well, for I think it is totally accurate to call what Russia did an attack on our country. That's exactly what it was. And much of the warfare in this age against state actors is going to be cyber related. We've seen that already with North Korea, with some of their hacks. We've seen it with Iran. We've seen it with Russia. We've seen it with China, frankly. And so we have to treat. You saw this with the hacked emails. We thought differently because these emails were hacked than if someone had, you know, in Nixon style, broken into the Democratic National Committee and taken those documents as opposed to just stealing them over the internet. So we have to be very aggressive in our response, but also how we talk about hacking and these sort of interference efforts. Second, the reason why I'm hesitant to use treason is let's find out what people did. Let's find out if, you know, quote unquote, collusion happened. We know that there was attempted collusion because apparently everyone on the Trump campaign was meeting with Russians all the time. Let's wait till Bob Mueller offers us his report on Russia and their efforts in the elections and how they work with the Trump campaign, and let's see what it is. And then hopefully there will be legal action, and prosecutors can decide what charges to bring, and then we can describe them as such.
There's a comment, actually a question from Ian. I'm not sure how he's using this word, but he says Robert Scheer of Scheer Intelligence said Bernie Sanders was the right kind of demagogue. I've heard the same thing said of Obama. Can we get a successful candidate who isn't a demagogue in today's media environment?
Yeah, I don't know that I would consider Bernie Sanders a demagogue.
I think as much as I have had respect for the years of Bob Scheer, I think that's an incorrect word to use about. Maybe they're talking about charisma, though, you know. I mean, it occurs to me sometimes in my own analysis of things that, You need candidates who have charisma. Trump had it, has it. Clinton had it, has it. Obama had it, has it. Even Bush, to some degree, has it. There's something about, you know, that magnetism that you get from certain political candidates that others simply don't have.
I think that's right. There are candidates, you either have it, I don't know whether you have it or you don't, but the ability to be, to make an argument in a way that people understand and to be, I hate the term likable, but to be compelling in how you give your message is very important. Bernie Sanders did a phenomenal job articulating a very specific argument about the economy and corruption in this country. And Democrats are going to have to, I mean, maybe it'll be Bernie Sanders again making that case in 2020. But I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from the Sanders campaign, because what he achieved in terms of going from where he was sort of basically unknown to challenging Hillary Clinton was very impressive.
Dan Pfeiffer, good to have you with us this morning. I appreciate your time and congratulations again on your new baby and your book.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. By the way, Dan Pfeiffer's book, again, is called Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. And he'll be at City Arts and Lectures Tuesday, June 26th at 7:30 in the Commonwealth Club in Silicon Valley, Wednesday at June 27th at 7 p.m. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Tomorrow, in our second hour, we're going to look into the world of Hasidism with Professor David Bialy. I hope you join us for that. It's been a Netflix show about Hasidism. It's getting a lot of attention and certainly has political nuances to it in the United States and around the world. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.